And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. We've been reading Ivanhoe, and we're up to a fascinating point where Friar Tuck is regaling the sluggard knight, and the knight has told him that no one values Englishmen more than he does. But before we go on, a word from the people who help make our station possible.
The Araluen Valley Hotel offers visitors and locals a welcoming bar with cold beer on tap, a games room and a beer garden. Open 5 days a week, Wednesday to Sunday, with delicious Sunday roasts at lunch and dinner. Bistro meals serve from 12 to 2pm and 6 to 8pm. Strictly observing COVID guidelines, every visitor is required to register on entry by digital sign-on. Araluen Valley Hotel. Find us on Facebook or phone 4846 4023. Supporting our local radio station, Braidwood FM 88.9.
Specialising in rural conveyancing and succession planning, Chamberlain's Law Firm are with you for all your legal needs. No matter how big or small, their lawyers can assist with a range of legal problems and advice. With offices in Braidwood, Canberra and Sydney, they have team members everywhere to assist you. Call Chamberlain's today on 6188 6200 or find them online at chamberlains.com.au to speak with their expert lawyers about your legal needs. Chamberlain's Law Firm, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Where should you go to see the future of farming? It's as close as White's Tractor Kubota dealer right now. The next generation of tractor has arrived, the remarkable M71 range. At the heart of Kubota's most powerful tractor ever is a 6.1 litre engine that delivers 170 horsepower of dynamic, clean efficiency like never before. At every level, the M71 has the technology that professional farming demands for success. Arrange a test drive at White's Tractor's new premises at 50 Robinson Street, Goulburn, and experience a new high-spec powerhouse from Kubota. White's Tractor's is happy to support Braidwood FM.
Braidwood FM sponsor Braidwood Air Conditioning is your local air conditioning specialist for the installation and servicing of commercial and residential premises. Ryan is licensed and insured and has been in the industry for over 12 years. You can contact Ryan on 0405 274 227 or email him at info@braidwoodairconditioning.com.au or visit the website braidwoodairconditioning.com.au.
Braidwood's Half-Cut Barber is now open at the Braidwood Hotel, offering traditional grooming services for the men of Braidwood. Open Tuesday to Friday, 12 noon to 6pm, and Saturday, 9am to 12 noon. Walk-ins are welcome. Contact Braidwood's Half-Cut Barber through their webpage. Proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you again to our sponsors who help make our station possible. Well, continuing on with Ivanhoe, for those who may be just catching up, Cedric, Isaac the Jew and his daughter, Rebecca, Rowena the ward of Cedric and Athelstane the descendant of King Harold have been taken prisoner and are on their way to a castle. Meanwhile, the Black Knight and Friar Tuck have been having a bit of a drinking session, and a yeoman, whom we think is probably Robin of Locksley, along with Garth and Womba, have turned up. "I would willingly believe so," said the woodsman, "for never had this country such need to be supported by those who love her. Hear me, and I will tell you of an enterprise in which, if you are really that which you seem, you may take an honourable part. A band of villains in the disguise of better men than themselves have made themselves master of the person of a noble Englishman called Cedric the Saxon, together with his ward and his friend Athelstane of Coningsburg, and have transported them to a castle in this forest called Torquilston. I ask you, as a good knight and a good Englishman, will you aid in their rescue?" "I am bound by my vow to do so," replied the knight, "but I would willingly know who you are who request my assistance on their behalf." "I am," said the forester, "a nameless man, but I am the friend of my country and my country's friends. With this account of me, you must for the present remain satisfied." the more so, especially since you yourself desire to continue unknown. Believe, however, that my word when pledged is as inviolate as if I wore golden spurs. I willingly believe it, said the knight. I have been accustomed to study men's countenances. I can read in yours honesty and resolution. I will therefore ask you no further questions, but aid you in setting at freedom those oppressed captives, which done, I trust we shall part better acquainted and well satisfied with each other. So, said Wamba to Garth, for the friar being now fully equipped, the jester having approached to the other side of the hut and heard the conclusion of the conversation, so, we have a new ally. I trust the valour of the knight will be truer metal than the religion of the hermit or the honesty of the yeoman, for this Locksley looks like a born deer-stealer, and the priest like a lusty hypocrite. Hold thy peace, Wamba, said Garth. It may all be as you guess, but were the horned devil to rise and proffer me his assistance to set at liberty Cedric and the Lady Rowena, I fear I should hardly have religion enough to refuse the foul fiend's offer and bid him get behind me. The friar was now completely accoutred as a yeoman, with sword and buckler, bow and quiver, and a strong partisan over his shoulder. He left his cell at the head of the party, and, having carefully locked the door, deposited the key under the threshold. "Are you in a condition to do good service, friar?" said Locksley. "Or does the brown bowl still run in your head?" "Not more than a draught of St. Dunstan's fountain will allay," answered the priest. "Something there is of a whizzing in my brain, and of instability in my legs, but you shall presently see both pass away." So saying, he stepped to the stone basin, in which the waters of the fountain, as they well formed bubbles, which danced in the white moonlight, and took so long a draught as if he had meant to exhaust the spring. "When did you drink as deep a draught of water before, Holy Clerk of Copmanhurst?" said the Black Knight.
Never since my wine butt leaked, and let out its liquor by an illegal vent," replied the friar, "and so left me nothing to drink but my patron saint's bounty, the water."
Then, plunging his hands and head into the fountain, he washed from them all marks of the midnight revel. Thus refreshed and sobered, the jolly priest twirled his heavy partisan around his head with three fingers, as if he had been balancing a reed, exclaiming at the same time, "Where be those false ravishers who carry off wenches against their will? May the foul fiend fly off with me if I'm not man enough for a dozen of them."
"Swearest you, Holy Clerk?" said the Black Knight.
"Clerk me no clerks," replied the transformed priest. "By St. George and the Dragon, I am no longer a shaveling than while my frock is on my back. When I am cased in my green cassock, I will drink, swear, and woo a lass with any blithe forester in the West Riding."
"Come on, Jack Priest," said Locksley, "and be silent. You are as noisy as a whole convent on a holy eve when the Father Abbot has gone to bed. Come on, you too, my masters, tarry not to talk of it. I say come on, we must collect all our forces. A few enough we shall have if we are to storm the castle of Reginald Front de Boeuf."
"What? Is it Front de Boeuf?" said the Black Knight. "Who has stopped on the king's highway the king's liege subjects? Is he turned thief and oppressor?"
"Oppressor he ever was," said Locksley.
"Ah, for the thief," said the priest, "I doubt if he ever were even half as honest a man as many a thief of my acquaintance."
"Move on, priest, and be silent," said the yeoman. "It were better you led the way to the place of rendezvous than say what should be left unsaid, both in decency and prudence."
Chapter 21.
While these measures were taking in behalf of Cedric and his companions, the armed men by whom the latter had been seized hurried their captives along towards the place of security where they intended to imprison them. But darkness came on fast, and the paths of the wood seemed but imperfectly known to the marauders. They were compelled to make several long halts, and once or twice to return on their road to resume the direction which they wished to pursue. The summer morn had dawned upon them before they could travel in full assurance that they held the right path. But confidence returned with light, and the cavalcade now moved rapidly forward. Meanwhile, the following dialogue took place between the two leaders of the bandits. "It is time you should leave us, Sir Maurice," said Templar de Bracy, "in order to prepare the second part of the mystery. You are next, you know, to act the knight deliverer." "I have thought better of it," said de Bracy. "I will not leave until the prize is fairly deposited at Fontebœuf's castle. There will I appear before the Lady Rowena in my own shape, and trust that she will set down to the vehemence of my passion the violence of which I have been guilty."
"And what has made you change your plan, de Bracy?" replied the Knight Templar.
"Ah, that concerns nothing for you," answered his companion. "I would hope, however, Sir Knight," said the Templar, "that this alteration of measure arises from no suspicion of my honourable meaning, such as Fitzurse endeavoured to instil in thee."
"My thoughts are my own," answered de Bracy. "The fiend laughs, they say, when one thief robs another. We know that were he to spit fire and brimstone, instead it would never prevent a Templar from following his bent."
"Or the leader of a free company," answered the Templar, "from dreading at the hands of a comrade and friend the injustice he does to all mankind."
"This is unprofitable and perilous recrimination," answered de Bracy. "Suffice it to say, I know the morals of the Temple Order, and I will not give you the power of cheating me out of the fair prey for which I have run such risks."
"Tah!" replied the Templar. "What have you to fear? You know the vows of our order."
"Yes, right well," said de Bracy, "and also how they are kept. Come, Sir Templar, the laws of gallantry have a liberal interpretation in Palestine, and this is a case in which I will trust nothing to your conscience."
"Well, hear the truth, then," said the Templar. "I care not for your blue-eyed beauty. There is in that train one who will make me a better mate."
"What? You would stoop to the waiting damsel?" said de Bracy.
"No, Sir Knight," said the Templar haughtily, "to the waiting woman I will not stoop. I have a prize among the captives as lovely as yours."
"By the mass, you mean the fair Jewess," said de Bracy.
"And if I do," said Bois Guilbert, "who shall gainsay me?"
"No one that I know," said de Bracy, "unless it be your vow of celibacy, or a check of conscience for an intrigue with a Jewess."
"For my vow," said the Templar, "our Grand Master has granted me a dispensation, and for my conscience, a man that has slain 300 Saracens need not reckon up every little failing, like a village girl at her first confession upon Good Friday Eve."
"You know best your own privileges," said de Bracy. "Yet I would have sworn your thoughts had been more on the old usurer's money bags than on the black eyes of the daughter."
"I can admire both," answered the Templar. "Besides, the old Jew is but half prize. I must share his spoils with Fontebœuf, who will not lend us the use of his castle for nothing. I must have something that I can term exclusively my own by this foray of ours, and I have fixed on the lovely Jewess as my peculiar prize. But now, you know my drift, you will resume your original plan, will you not? You have nothing, you see, to fear from my interference."
"No," replied de Bracy. "I will remain beside my prize. What you say is passing true, but I like not the privileges acquired by the dispensation of the Grand Master and the merit acquired by the slaughter of 300 Saracens. You have too good a right to a free pardon to render you very scrupulous about peccadilloes." While this dialogue was proceeding, Cedric was endeavouring to wring out of those who guarded him an avowal of their character and purpose.
"You should be Englishmen," said he, "and yet, sacred heaven, you prey upon your countrymen as if you were very Norman. You should be my neighbours, and if so, my friends, for which of my English neighbours have reason to be otherwise? I tell you, yeomen, that even those among you who have been branded with outlawry have had from me protection, for I have pitied their miseries and cursed the oppression of their tyrannic nobles. What then would you have of me? Or in what can this violence serve you? You are worse than brute beasts in your actions,
and will you imitate them in their very dumbness? It was in vain that Cedric expostulated with his guards, who had too many good reasons for their silence to be induced to break it either by his wrath or his expostulations. They continued to hurry him along, travelling at a very rapid rate, until at the end of an avenue of huge trees arose Torkelston, now the hoary and ancient castle of Reginald Front de Boeuf. It was a fortress of no great size, consisting of a donjon, or large and square, high square tower, surrounded by buildings of inferior height, which were encircled by an inner courtyard. Around the exterior wall was a deep moat, supplied with water from a neighbouring rivulet. Front de Boeuf, whose character placed him often at feud with his enemies, had made considerable additions to the strength of his castle by building towers upon the outward wall so as to flank it at every angle. The access, as usual in castles of the period, lay through an arched barbican or outwork, which was terminated and defended by a small turret at each corner. Cedric no sooner saw the turrets of Front de Boeuf's castle raise their grey and moss-grown battlements glimmering in the morning sun above the woods by which they were surrounded than he instantly augured more truly concerning the cause of his misfortune. "I did injustice," he said, "to the thieves and outlaws of these woods when I supposed such bandits to belong to their bands. I might have justly confounded the foxes of these brakes with the ravening wolves of France. Tell me, dogs, is it my life or my wealth that your master aims at? Is it too much that two Saxons, myself and the noble Athelstan, should hold land in the country which was once the patrimony of our race? Put us then to death and complete your tyranny by taking our lives as you began with our liberties. If the Saxon Cedric cannot rescue England, he is willing to die for her. Tell your tyrannical master, I do only beseech him to dismiss the Lady Rowena in honour and safety. She is a woman, and he need not dread her, and with us will die all who dare fight in her cause." The attendants remained as mute to this address as to the former, and now they stood before the gate of the castle. De Bracy winded his horn three times, and the archers and crossbowmen, who had manned the wall upon seeing their approach, hastened to lower the drawbridge and admit them. The prisoners were compelled by their guards to alight and were conducted to an apartment where a hasty repast was offered them, of which none but Athelstane felt any inclination to partake. Neither had the descendant of the confessor much time to do justice to the good cheer placed before them, for their guards gave him and Cedric to understand that they were to be imprisoned in a chamber apart from Rowena. Resistance was vain, and they were compelled to follow to a large room, which, rising on clumsy Saxon pillars, resembled those refectories or chapter houses which may still be seen in the most ancient parts of our most ancient monasteries. The Lady Rowena was next separated from her train, and conducted, with courtesy indeed, but still without consulting her inclination, to a distant apartment. The same alarming distinction was conferred on Rebecca, in spite of her father's entreaties, who offered even money in this extremity of distress, that she might be permitted to abide with him. "Base unbeliever," answered one of his guards, "when you have seen your lair, you will not wish your daughter with you." And without further discussion, the old Jew was forcibly dragged off in a different direction from the other prisoners. The domestics, after being carefully searched and disarmed, were confined in another part of the castle, and Rowena was refused even the comfort she might have derived from the tendance of her handmaiden, Elgitha. The apartment in which the Saxon chiefs were confined, for to them we turn our first attention, although at present used as a sort of guard room, had formerly been the great hall of the castle. It was now abandoned to meaner purposes, because the present lord, among other additions to the convenience, security, and beauty of his baronial residence, had erected a new and noble hall, whose vaulted roof was supported by lighter and more elegant pillars, and fitted up with that higher degree of ornament which the Normans had already introduced into architecture. Cedric paced the apartment, filled with indignant reflections on the past and on the present, while the apathy of his companion served, instead of patience and philosophy, to defend him against everything
save the inconvenience of the present moment, and so little did he feel even this last that he was only from time to time roused to a reply by Cedric's animated and impassioned appeal to him. "Yes," said Cedric, half speaking to himself and half addressing himself to Athelstan. "It was in this very hall my ancestors feasted with Torquil Wolfganger when he entertained the valiant and unfortunate Harald, then advancing against the Norwegians, who had united themselves to the rebel Tosti. It was in this hall that Harald returned the magnanimous answer to the ambassador of his rebel brother. Oft have I heard my father kindle as he told the tale. The envoy of Tosti was admitted when this ample room could scarce contain the crowd of noble Saxon leaders who were quaffing the blood-red wine around their monarch. I hope," said Athelstane, somewhat moved by this part of his friend's discourse, "they will not forget to send us some wine and refreshments at noon. We have scarce had a breathing space allowed to break our fast, and I never have the benefit of my food when I eat immediately after dismounting from a horse, though the leeches recommend it." Cedric went on with his story without noticing this interjectional observation of his friend. "The envoy of Tosti," he said, "moved up the hall, undismayed by the frowning countenances of all around him, till he made his obeisance before the throne of King Harald. 'What terms," he said, "Lord King, hath thy brother Tosti to hope if he should lay down his arms and crave peace at thy hands?" "A brother's love," cried the generous Harald, "and the fair earldom of Northumberland." "But should Tosti accept these terms," continued the envoy, "what land shall be assigned to his faithful ally, Hardrada, King of Norway?" 7 feet of English ground," answered Harald fiercely. "Or, as Hardrada is said to be a giant, perhaps we may allow him 12 inches more." The hall rung with acclamations, and cup and horn was filled to the Norwegian who should be speedily in possession of his English territory. I could have pledged him with all my soul," said Athelstane, "for my tongue cleaves to my palate." "The baffled envoy," continued Cedric, pursuing with animation his tale, though it interested not the listener, "retreated to carry Tosti and his ally the ominous answer of his injured brother. It was then that the distant towers of York and the bloody streams of the Derwent beheld that direful conflict in which, after displaying the most undaunted valour, the King of Norway and Tosti both fell, with 10,000 of their bravest followers. Who would have thought that upon the proud day when this battle was won, the very gale which waved the Saxon banners in triumph was filling the Norman sails and impelling them to the fatal shores of Sussex? Who would have thought that Harald, within a few brief days, would himself possess no more of his kingdom than the share which he allotted in his wrath to the Norwegian invader? Who would have thought that you, noble Athelstan, that you, descended of Harald's blood, and that I, whose father was not the worst defender of the Saxon crown, should be prisoners to a vile Norman in the very hall in which our ancestors held such high festival?" "It is sad enough," replied Athelstan, "but I trust they will hold us to a moderate ransom. At any rate, it cannot be their purpose to starve us outright, and yet, although it is high noon, I see no preparations for serving dinner." "Look up at the window," said Rick, "and judge by the sunbeams if it is not on the verge of noon." "It may be so," answered Cedric, "but I cannot look upon that stained lattice with its awakening other reflections than those which concern the passing moment or its privations. When that window was wrought, my noble friend, our hardy fathers knew not the art of making glass or of staining it. The pride of Wolfganger's father brought an artist from Normandy to adorn this hall with this new species of emblazonment that breaks the golden light of God's blessed day into so many fantastic hues. The foreigner came here, poor, beggarly, cringing and subservient, ready to doff his cap to the meanest native of the household.
he returned, pampered and proud, to tell his rapacious countrymen the wealth and the simplicity of Saxon nobles. Oh, folly, folly, Athelstan, foreboded of old as well as foreseen by those descendants of Hengist and his hardy tribes who retained the simplicity of their manners. We made these strangers our bosom friends, our confidential servants. We borrowed their artists and their arts. We despised the honest simplicity and hardihood with which our brave ancestors supported themselves. We became enervated by Norman arts long before we fell under Norman arms. Far better was our homely diet eaten in peace and liberty than the luxurious dainties, the love of which has delivered us as bondsmen to a foreign conqueror. I should, replied Athelstane, hold very humble diet a luxury at present, and it astonishes me, noble Cedric, that you can bear so truly in mind the memory of past deeds when it appears you forget the very hour of dinner. It is time lost, muttered Cedric apart and impatiently, to speak to him of aught else but that which concerns his appetite. The soul of Hardicanute has taken possession of him, and he has no pleasure save to fill, to swill, and to call for more. Alas, said he, looking at Athelstan with compassion, that so dull a spirit should be lodged in so goodly a form. Alas, that such an enterprise as the regeneration of England should turn on a hinge so imperfect. Wedded to Rowena, indeed, her noble and more generous soul may yet awake the better nature which is torpid within him. Yet how should this be, while Rowena, Athelstan, and myself remain the prisoners of this brutal marauder, and have been made so perhaps from a sense of the dangers which our liberty might bring to the usurped power of his nation? While the Saxon was plunged in these painful reflections, the door of their prison opened and gave entrance to a sewer holding his white rod of office. This important person advanced into the chamber with a grave pace, followed by four attendants bearing in a table covered with dishes, the sight and smell of which seemed to be an instant compensation to Athelstan for all the inconvenience he had undergone. The persons who attended on the feast were masked and cloaked. "What mummery is this?" said Cedric. "Think you we're ignorant whose prisoners we are, when we are in the castle of your master? Tell him," he continued, willing to use this opportunity to open a negotiation for his freedom. "Tell your master, Reginald Fondibouf, that we know no reason he can have for withholding our liberty, excepting his unlawful desire to enrich himself at our expense. Tell him that we yield to his rapacity, as in similar circumstances we should do to that of a literal robber. Let him name the ransom at which he rates our liberty. It will be paid, providing the exaction is suited to our means." The sewer made no answer, but bowed his head. And tell Sir Reginald Fondibouf, said Athelstan, that I send him my mortal defiance, and challenge him to combat with me on foot or horseback at any secure place within 8 days after our liberation, which if he be a true knight, he will not, under these circumstances, venture to refuse or to delay. I shall deliver the knight your defiance, answered the sewer. Meanwhile, I leave you your food. The challenge of Athelstan was delivered with no good grace, for a large mouthful, which required the exercise of both jaws at once, added to a natural hesitation, considerably damped the effect of the bold defiance it contained. Still, however, his speech was hailed by Cedric as an incontestable token of reviving spirit in his companion, whose previous indifference had begun, notwithstanding his respect for Athelstan's descent, to wear out his patience. But he now cordially shook hands with him, in token of his approbation, and was somewhat grieved when Athelstan observed that he would fight a dozen such men as Front de Boeuf. By so doing he could hasten his departure from a dungeon where they put so much garlic into their pottage.
Notwithstanding this intimation of a relapse into the apathy of sensuality, Cedric placed himself opposite to Athelstan, and soon showed that if the distresses of his country could banish the recollection of food while the table was uncovered, yet no sooner were the victuals put there than he proved that the appetite of his Saxon ancestors had descended to him, along with their other qualities. The captives had not long enjoyed their refreshment, however, before their attention was disturbed even from this most serious occupation by the blast of a horn winded before the gate. It was repeated 3 times with as much violence as if it had been blown before an enchanted castle by the destined knight at whose summons halls and towers, bubbican and battlement were to roll off like a morning vapour. The Saxons started from the table and hastened to the window, but their curiosity was disappointed, for those outlets only looked upon the court of the castle, and the sound came from beyond its precincts. The summons, however, seemed of importance, for a considerable degree of bustle instantly took place in the castle. Chapter 22. Leaving the Saxon chiefs to return to their banquet as soon as their ungratified curiosity should permit them to attend to the calls of their half-satiated appetite, we have to look in upon the yet more severe imprisonment of Isaac of York. The poor Jew had been hastily thrown into a dungeon vault of the castle, the floor of which was deep beneath the level of the ground, and very damp, being lower than even the moat itself. The only light was received through 1 or 2 loopholes, far above the reach of the captive's hand. These apertures admitted, even at midday, only a dim and uncertain light, which was changed for utter darkness long before the rest of the castle had lost the blessing of day. Chains and shackles, which had been the portion of former captives, from whom active exertions to escape had been apprehended, hung rusted and empty on the walls of the prison, and in the rings of one of those sets of fetters there remained 2 mouldering bones, which seemed to have once been those of a human leg, as if the prisoner had been left not only to perish there, but to be consumed to a skeleton. At one end of this ghastly apartment was a large fire grate, over the top of which were stretched some transverse iron bars, half devoured with rust. The whole appearance of the dungeon might have appalled a stouter heart than that of Isaac, who nevertheless was more composed under the imminent pressure of danger than he had seemed to be, while affected by terrors of which the cause was as yet remote and contingent. The lovers of the chase say that the hare feels more agony during the pursuit of the greyhounds than when she is struggling in their fangs. And thus it is probable that the Jews, by the very frequency of their fear on all occasions, had their minds in some degree prepared for every effort of tyranny which could be practised upon them, so that no aggression, when it had taken place, could bring with it that surprise which is the most disabling quality of terror. Neither was it the first time that Isaac had been placed in circumstances so dangerous. He had, therefore, experience to guide him as well as hope that he might again, as formerly, be delivered as a prey from the fowler. Above all, he had upon his side the unyielding obstinacy of his nation, and that unbending resolution with which Israelites have been frequently known to submit to the uttermost evils which power and violence can inflict upon them, rather than gratify their oppressors by granting their demands. In this humour of passive resistance, and with his garment collected beneath him to keep his limbs from the wet pavement, Isaac sat in a corner of his dungeon, where his folded hands, his dishevelled hair and beard, his furred cloak and high cap, seen by the wiry and broken light, would have afforded a study for Rembrandt had that celebrated painter existed at the period. The Jew remained without altering his position for nearly 3 hours, at the expiry of which steps were heard on the dungeon stair. The bolts screamed as they were withdrawn, the hinges creaked as the wicket opened, and Reginald Front de Boeuf, followed by 2 Saracen slaves of the Templar, entered the prison. Front de Boeuf, a tall and strong man, whose life had been spent in public war or in private feuds and broils, and who had hesitated at no means of extending his feudal power, and had features corresponding to his character, and which strongly expressed the fiercer and more malignant passions of the mind. Scars with which his visage was seamed would, on features of a different cast, have excited the sympathy and veneration due to the marks of honourable valour. But in the peculiar case of Front de Boeuf, they only added to the ferocity of his countenance and to the dread which his presence inspired. This formidable baron was clad in a leathern doublet fitted close to his body, which was frayed and soiled with the stains of his armour. He had no weapon except a poniard at his belt, which served to counterbalance the weight of the bunch of rusty keys that hung on his right side. The black slaves who attended Front de Boeuf were stripped of their gorgeous apparel and attired in jerkins and trousers of coarse linen, their sleeves being tucked up above the elbow, like those of butchers when about to exercise their functions in the slaughterhouse. Each had in his hand a small pannier, and when they entered the dungeon, they stopped at the door until Front de Boeuf himself carefully locked and then double-locked it. Having taken this precaution, he advanced slowly up the apartment towards the Jew, upon whom he kept his eye fixed, as if he wished to paralyze him with his glance, as some animals are said to fascinate their prey. It seemed indeed as if the sullen and malignant eye of Front de Boeuf possessed some portion of that supposed power over his unfortunate prisoner. The Jew sat with his mouth agape and his eyes fixed on the savage baron with such earnestness of terror that his frame seemed literally to shrink together and to diminish in size while encountering the fierce Norman's fixed and baleful gaze. The unhappy Isaac was deprived not only of the power of rising to make obeisance, which his terror dictated, but he could not even doff his cap or utter any word of supplication, so strongly was he agitated by the conviction that tortures and death were impending over him. On the other hand, the stately form of the Norman appeared to dilate in magnitude, like that of an eagle which ruffles its plumage when about to pounce on its defenceless prey. He paused within 3 steps of the corner in which the unfortunate Jew had now, as it were, coiled himself up into the smallest possible space and made a sign for one of the slaves to approach. The black satellite came forward accordingly, and producing from his basket a large pair of scales and several weights, he laid them at the feet of Front de Boeuf, and again retired to a respectful distance at which his companion had already taken his station. Well, that's our book reading for this week. Isaac looks like he's in for a rather rough time, and we don't know what's happened to Rowena or Rebecca. And what about the mysterious horn sounding outside Tocquan? We'll have to wait till next week. Till then, keep well, Braidwood.
Play me a country song. You don't